this is the second half of the talk about cultural studies. And I want to look now at the next generation, the next few years, and what people came up with. And this book by Dick Hebdiger, which came out in the 1970s, I'm pretty sure, The Meaning of Subculture, The Meaning of Style, was one of the very influential pieces to come out of the Birmingham School. And again, it's difficult to imagine today, but you have to imagine yourself back in the 1970s, where the idea of university professors studying punk and mods and rockers was very shocking. Even today, it's not completely accepted. When I was looking for a job 2 years ago, some of the professors on... You study popular music. It's not quite accepted. Hebdiger, so what did he come up with? Well, this is... you don't need to note this down. This is the contents page. So subculture, the meaning of style. So what he did was he took different, what he called subcultures. Hippies, heavy metal, punk... he didn't look at punk, so on. Rastafarianism. He said, what does it mean? What is the appeal? What is their effect on society? What is their effect on identity? And let's study how they work. And so here you can have, here you see a series of, no, en fait, c'est forcément plus tard, parce que ça doit être la fin des années 70, en fait. Here you have some examples. So chapter 2, Holiday in the Sun, of course, is about punks. That's a Sex Pistols song, Holiday in the Sun. Chapter 3 about Rastafarianism and the Back to Africa currents within music. And chapter 4 about hipsters, beats and teddy boys, the mods, punks, glam rock and glitter rock, all of those things together. And remember, so what he's looking at is the question of identity. Why is it popular? How does it work? And I have here, I hope, some examples. Obviously not. I have here some examples. Well, I'll just open it up and I'll give you one example that you probably know quite well. Which is a... Bob Marley piece.
Some are free.
Okay, so Bob Marley, did you know this song? Yeah, some people yes, some people don't. Okay. So, a few interesting things about this. First of all, the story is about being kidnapped from Africa and taken as a slave, and surviving because of the songs. Okay? So, it's a whole cultural configuration made around the experience of slavery, the terrible experience of slavery, and the cultural memory of slavery, and of course all the results of slavery, racism, and so on. Now, can you see at the top what's written at the top? Redemption Song, live in Dortmund, Germany. Okay. How many of the audience do you think are black Africans?
Not many,
yeah? And so this is what Dick Hebdiger wanted to study. How come, I'm sure 2% of the audience are black, and it's Germany, you know, and how come this kind of story, coming from a specific cultural experience, becomes something which many, many people want to take in, listen to, sing, imitate, because of course you've got the dreadlocks, and you also have white people who do the dreadlocks too. So all this, what is going on? You know, what is this identity and identification? What is the meaning of style? What is the meaning of style? Now, I'm not going to go into the details. I just want to open up some of the questions so you can see what has been done. And reggae, of course, became, especially Bob Marley, became massively popular, whereas some reggae, which was more, which had a more aggressive ideology, did not become so popular. And of course, there's also the industry side of it. A lot of money was made from Bob Marley. So there's all these different things going on. But the center of it is, what is the meaning of style? What does it mean to identify with Rastafarianism? Quite often, when you're somewhere quite different. Now, of course, if you want to be ungenerous, you could say, well, all these white Germans, they're just being hypocritical. They understand nothing about what he's really thinking about. But it may be more complicated than that people take music from elsewhere and see their own experiences in it. You know, they identify in it. That was one example. I have another example for you. Along this idea of how important it is for people. And if you like, you can sing along because we have the words here. This is from America. This is a country music song. A very popular country music song. Some of the lyrics are very, very interesting. So, circling the drive-in cinema. Yeah, a drive-in cinema, that's what it is. And turning down, so she stops the car and she turns down the music she was listening to, which was George Jones, who I imagine is a great country singer. And you hear that when she sings that, all the audience say, yeah, George Jones. You know, they identify there. The next bit I like as well. It must be a country thing to do, I guess.
I'm
So, a lot of things going on there. First of all, notice that what happens with music is that she doesn't just listen to country music or sing country music, she is country. So country is something you can be, yeah? Just like you can be a punk, or you can be, I don't know if you can be hip-hop, but you can be a rapper, and so this whole very strong sense of identity. These were symbolized in the late 60s by fighting between the mods and the rockers in Britain, where the mods represented a respect for English music and the rockers for American music. So there's all these things going on at the time. Just one last example, and then I'll go on to other elements. And this is a song by the Tubes called "I Was a Punk Before You Were a Punk." So I was a punk before you were a punk. Now, perhaps they are parodying the idea, because it's a slightly ridiculous idea. Of course, I was a punk before you were a punk. But then, in a way, it's the same song. Yeah, I was country when country wasn't cool. It's the same song as I was a punk before you were a punk. It's the same idea. But I don't know why. Maybe I'm biased. But I get the impression that the punks may be being ironic, and that the country person wasn't. But that may be my own prejudice. In any case, these are all elements which show how, in particular music, but not only music, becomes part of an identity, which is a way that people negotiate their existence in a life which is, you know, not always easy. And people do want to sing and listen about these imaginary worlds, because punk and Rastafarianism and so on are imaginary worlds, just because, well, if you sing a song about j'ai fait trois DSTs cette semaine et j'en ai marre, I don't know, there are no songs about this. It's absolutely fascinating, because the percentage of people in France who buy music who are students is very high. But the number of songs writing about what I hear students talking about in the corridors is very low. Yes, sir. So, c'était pas juste comment il nous a filé le DST sans nous avertir. Do you think it would make a good rap song? Not sure. Normally, popular music has to be more melodramatic. So it's, you know, the police are trying to kill me, and I hope I'll kill them first. You know, it's much, much more melodramatic. You know, whereas normally this doesn't happen to us on an ordinary day, although it is getting more common. The second half of the book, the second half of Hebdiger's book, The Function of Subculture, The Source of Style, Subculture and Incorporation, how subcultures can become used for all sorts of things. Perhaps you have heard of Johnny Rotten, the great punk singer from the Sex Pistols. Well, he appeared 2 or 3 years ago, I think, in advertisements to sell British butter. So just to, so that, like, this is what we call incorporation, yeah, incorporation. Okay, and finally, at the end then, culture and arts. And this book by Hebdiger led to a whole load of studies of subcultures, for example, punk and skinheads, which could involve all sorts of disciplinary methods. For example, if you look at the skinhead, then it's possible to understand, to wonder, what are the meaning? You know, you have the braces, which is very old. People don't have them anymore. Very, very 19th century, early 20th century in Britain. The skinhead, you know, why? What is the meaning of there being no hair? Well, if you have no hair, you look like a baby. I mean, I don't have the final answer on this or anything, but there are many things that can be studied. When you look at the punks, one of the famous things about the punk dressing was the safety pin, yeah, le pagne de nourrice. And the symbolism of refusing to be an adult seems to be quite relatively clear, I would think. You also have in the punk repertoire some of the punks who used to wear Nazi symbols. Not because they were fascists and not because they knew anything about fascists, but just because they noticed that nobody liked this. Yeah, and so the idea of choc épaté le bourgeois, comme on dit en français, the Union Jack and so on. So there you have the skinhead and there you have the punks. Although punk did have quite a wide variety. One of the interesting things about punk dress in the 1970s was that quite a lot of the English punks would wear school uniform. They would wear school uniform, but torn or destroyed, yeah? So it's a kind of mockery. Of course, school uniform was very, very common in Britain. But it was also, again, refusing to grow up. But refusing adult life is a constant of youth culture. I mean, I think I mentioned to you the great original rock and roll song, Rock Around the Clock, yeah? We're refusing to go to bed. Yeah, so it's a very, very clear thing going on there. I have a couple more there. At the bottom, then, the Rasta sort of look. And above that, this is the rockers. Very interesting. These are rockers from Britain. Very interesting thing about rockers, because it actually says the word rocker underneath, you know. So it's very clear. It's actually written rocker. And this is the Southern Cross, of course, from the south of the United States in the Civil War. All of these sort of representations of sort of an old-fashioned American against the mods who were going for the England one. So studying subculture is one aspect of cultural studies which went on for quite a long time. And this book in 2000 was in some ways a reply to Hebdiger's book. This is called Inside Subculture, The Postmodern Meaning of Style by David Muggleton. And he claimed that the problem with Hebdiger's approach is that Hebdiger had not sufficiently taken into account what the people actually said about their own style. And so he says, if you want to know about punk, you need to listen to what punks say. If you want to know about hip-hop, you need to listen to what hip-hop people say. And so this is a sort of ongoing study around these lines. Okay, so going back to more generally to cultural studies and some of the concerns, some of the questions. One of the questions I already mentioned is the idea of cultural ideas, cultural ideology, cultural practices as being connected with power in society. That we are, the elite prefer us to see things in a certain way and prefer us not to see things in another way. And certainly every generation has its music attacked by the establishment, at least until recently. And so the cultural studies people felt that culture was the terrain on which ideological representations of class, gender or race are enforced and contested by social groups validating their experience. So culture, for example, if you take the James Bond movies, yeah, they're obviously very traditional in the roles of men and the roles of women in them. And they also reinforce the role of the British in the world. It's very interesting to see how the enemies of James Bond has changed. It used to be, you know, Orientals, and then it was Russians, and now it's terrorists, because the dominant idea of who should be the enemy has changed. And one of the words, one of the terms that we use a lot in this sort of study is hegemony. And hegemony, it's a rather particular word, which it means domination. It doesn't mean exactly the same as domination, but it means domination. So a hegemonic idea is an idea which most people accept. Yeah. So it could be considered to be seen as common sense, but it might be a common prejudice. It might be something which is not true, but which most people accept. Hegemony explains how society is bound together without the use of force under the moral and intellectual leadership of the ruling classes. Hegemony operates in the realm of representations and consciousness. What do people see themselves as? You know, oh, well, I could never change this, I could never change that. This is part of the effects of hegemony. It naturalizes a class ideology. So hegemonic ideas will say, oh, well, you know, there have always been rich people and poor people, and this will never change. Now, this is obviously an idea which is useful to rich people, because if everybody thinks it will never change, it certainly will never change. Hegemony naturalizes a class ideology and renders it in the form of common sense. It's just common sense. You don't need to argue it. Everybody knows that, you know, whatever, that that the market economy is eternal. And intellectuals are one group of people who forge consent to help to apply consent. When they say intellectuals, they mean teachers mostly, but also doctors, journalists, and so on. Forge consent in the interest of the ruling class. Now, these ideas come from Antonio Gramsci. He's the person who first underlined the idea of hegemony. He was born in 1891. Was one of the founders of the Italian Communist Party in 1921, was imprisoned by the fascist government in 1926, stayed in prison for 11 years before dying in prison due to the harsh conditions. His most famous writings are the prison notebooks. They're rather difficult to read because he had to write them in a special way because there was censorship. So he couldn't write, the Communist Party should do this, because the censors would cross it. And so he used to write, the modern prince should be concerned with this. He wrote everything in code. And he always said, the modern prince, for the Communist Party, for example, and so on. This is okay, codes are okay, but some of his codes are very difficult. So then people argue about what he really meant. So he certainly came up with, he founded the Italian Communist Party in 1921. So his big problem when he was in prison in 1926 was there was a problem. At the end of the First World War, there was a revolution in Russia in 1917, in Germany in 1918 and 1923, not successful. General strikes in Italy. And then everything, after 1923, everything more or less calmed down. And so Gramsci, as a communist, said, well, why did everything calm down? According to our theories, it shouldn't have calmed down. And so he began to look at what makes people accept capitalist society. And that's where all these ideas come from. And here are because he noticed, he said, well, really, everything calmed down about 1923, after 1923, but not only because of the use of force. Somehow, the system managed to get the consent of most people. So hegemony relies on negotiation and consent and is exercised through authority and not physical force, operating through institutions such as the educational system, the media, and the family. Competing classes achieve a compromise equilibrium. So for example, in Europe today, it's considered, on the one hand, you know, if you're not rich, well, that's your problem. On the other hand, we do not normally accept that people just die of starvation in the streets. That we not most people consider that it's the responsibility of society to stop people dying of starvation, but that it's not the responsibility of society to make everybody rich. And so this is a compromise, if you like, that there are some things which are accepted by everybody and other things which are conflictual. And according to the cultural studies people, popular culture is an arena of resistance but also of enforcing hegemony. That is to say that popular culture, cinema or music or arts or street art, can be used to reinforce the present system. Yeah? You can go and see 1,000 films about how only pretty girls are happy, and aggressive girls never get anywhere. That's there are 1,000 films like that, and they all help us to see the world in this way. But on the other hand, you can have music or films which say, "Hey, let's look at things a little differently." So both are possible. That's the idea. And strangely enough, we often think of culture as not political, but in fact, it's very political. It's very political indeed. Okay, so that's cultural studies, and at the same time, or rather a little after cultural studies, a whole series of other areas of study were set up in Britain and elsewhere. And these might be, originally I wrote on this slide, the children of cultural studies, but that's not true. They're really more the cousins, because they had a certain independent origin to it. Yeah, and here are some of them. I hope that's interesting. Here are some of them. Media studies, gender studies, queer studies, post-colonial studies and popular music studies. Those are just some examples. But really, once they'd got accepted the idea that popular culture was worth studying, they'll say, hey, well, let's have television studies. So now you can go to university. Not a lot of universities, but some universities, you can do a degree in television studies. Now, it's interesting because it's become accepted in the university, but not very accepted. Do you know anybody who's doing a degree in television studies? Yeah? You have to know which university to go to. Yeah, it's a little bit accepted. So let's have a look at a couple of these, which can come along and use some of the methods and ideas of cultural studies and take them in a particular way. So here you have the one example, the media studies. So there you have the television, the old and the new television, the 1970s television at the top right, and the latest modern television just a little below. And in the United Kingdom, media studies began to develop in the 1960s, indeed in 1966, so 2 years after in Birmingham they established the Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies. In Leicester University, they established the Centre for Mass Communication Research. Again, it's not an accident that the first Centre for Mass Communication Research was not at Oxford, not at Cambridge, and not in London. They had to be a little bit marginal to get it accepted. Also, if you're in the Leicester University, you're not taking so many risks, because, you know, nobody thinks you're important. So, you know, whereas if you were in Oxford University, it would be a big risk to do something like this. And degree programs in media studies began to grow up in polytechnics, and other universities joined the 1970s and 1980s. And media studies is now taught all over the UK, even at high school. You do media studies at GCSE. You can take an exam in media studies when you're 16 or when you're 18, GCSE and A-level. Perhaps you remember that people normally take 7 to 11 GCSEs when they're 16, and 3 or 4 A-levels when they're 18. So very specialised the last 2 years. So that's media studies. And here just have an example of one problem which might be researched or studied in media studies, reality television. Of course, it's very popular for people to say that they love or hate reality television, but you don't often see people say, well, what exactly is it? And in fact, very often people just use the caricature examples like Big Brother. Whereas in fact, there are many, many, many different types. Yeah, I don't know if you saw Airports, called The Voice, Gogglebox, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, that's Un Dîner Presque Parfait in France. Undercover Boss, what's it called in France? Le Patron. Again? Le patois incognito. Yeah, so these are all very, in fact, very different. But they're all reality television in the sense that we watch people who are not actors doing things from their everyday life. Also, Recherche appartement. That's all, it's also reality television. It's people's real problems. Gogglebox. Gogglebox. I don't know if you have Gogglebox in France. Maybe you do. It's a strange program where, in fact, you watch people watching television. You just have a group. You just watch people watching television. I've never really looked at it in any detail. So what kinds of reality television have grown up? What were their predecessors? Quiz shows, talent shows and documentaries. What audiences do the different kinds of reality television attract and why? And what are the hidden messages? These are the kinds of questions that you might ask in media studies. And there you have a couple of books, media studies books, critique of the sitcom. You know, what does the sitcom show us about what is normal, what we should be living like, etc. People are sending me messages. And the one on the right is quite a famous book called Watching Dallas. This was a well-known one, Soap Opera and the Melodramatic Imagination. And it was about what people loved about Dallas. Now, you could write the same book about Downton Abbey, I'm sure, which just to update it a little bit. Gender studies, then another cousin of cultural studies. Gender studies is a field for interdisciplinary study devoted to gender identity and gendered representation as central categories of analysis. So you can analyse women's magazines, you can analyse rock music or classical music from the point of view of how is it practiced differently by men and women, and how is it understood differently and accepted differently by men and women. Of course, famously regarding gender, Simone de Beauvoir said, "One is not born a woman; one becomes one." Yeah, on n'est pas femme, on la devient. This view proposes that in gender studies, the term gender should be used to refer to the social and cultural constructions of masculinities and femininities, and not to the state of being male or female in its entirety. And there you can see some of the books which have been produced. 50 key concepts in gender studies. 50 key concepts in gender studies, yeah? You have to get up early to learn all 50 of them. The second book in the middle, these are just examples, is about drawing, le dessin, the history of drawing and how men and women have been involved in that. And on the right, Language and Women's Place. This is by Robin Lakoff, a famous linguist, about how language reflects gender differences. So that's gender studies. And here are a couple of examples about an area which I know less about, queer studies. So they at the top, these are university books, yeah. The Routledge Queer Studies Reader. Now, a reader is always a series of important articles. That's a reader. So it's like the 10 most important articles you should be reading about this question. In the middle, yeah, Gaga Feminism. Yeah, about Lady Gaga and her particular view or her particular representation of sex, gender, and the end of normal. Yeah, and then the last one, then gay, lesbian, and queer essays on popular culture, all the ways that sexuality has been presented and represented. You know, of course, from David Bowie to Lady Gaga or Katy Perry, and so on. Or more recent people I haven't heard of. Finally then, post-colonial studies. Post-colonial studies uses the methods of cultural studies really to look at the relations of power between the First World and the rest of the world, between the richer North and the poorer South. Post-colonial then, you know, so looking at the world. Trying to stop looking at the world in a colonial way. Post-colonial studies is an academic discipline featuring methods of intellectual discourse that analyse, explain and respond to the cultural legacies of colonialism and imperialism. Analysing the politics of knowledge, creation, control and distribution, by analysing the functional relations of social and political power that sustain colonialism and neocolonialism. The how and the why of an imperial regime's representations, social, political, cultural, of the imperial coloniser and of the colonised people. I don't know, there was a film on the television the other night, what was it called? Magumbu, a 1950s film. And it's about English people in Africa. And it's an extremely colonial vision of the world. And here are three of the three books of that. The two on the left are classics. Franz Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks is about experience of being colonized both physically and psychologically. So the idea of being black but pretending to be white. And Edward Said's Orientalism is a classic about how the West has exoticized the rest of the world and looked at it through an exotic filter. And the last one is just an introductory book. This is University Journal, Postcolonial Studies. Yeah, this is where you can get this is something that comes out every 3 months with important essays on the question. Oh, this one of my friends wrote this book, Heroic Imperialists in Africa, The Promotion of British and French Colonial Heroes from 1870 to 1939. And what he did was he took 10 colonial heroes from France and from Britain and examined how people had written school books about them and written films about them and made statues to them and named roads after them and all the way that the hero myth was constructed. Very typical of cultural studies, he's not looking at the lives of these colonial people. He's looking at the representations, how their image was used politically and culturally. That's very much the cultural studies way of looking at it. We're very, very interested in representations, the history of representations, and that will be the centre of it. Now, just to finish with a couple of... just a few minutes and then you'll be free, but for the moment, shut up. Thank you. Okay, just to finish with a couple of approaches, because naturally I'm more or less defending the approach of cultural studies, because that's why I'm giving you a whole semester on popular culture. But there are some approaches which are against cultural studies, and here is one of them, sociobiology. And this has a certain popularity since the publication now, quite a number of years ago, of Richard Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene. And Dawkins, according to somebody else, Dawkins presents a version of sociobiology that rested heavily on metaphors drawn from animal behaviour and extrapolated these. So the idea of the selfish gene is that social behaviour can be explained by the, just like animal behaviour, by the desire of using sophisticated cultural means to have the best chance of reproducing. To have the best chance of having children so that your genes continue. However, he's being criticised here by Mr. Hayes, who says the problem is selection. That is to say that the sociobiologists tend to say, here is something which human beings do. It's just the same as what animals do. Here, there's the example of the animal kingdom. But the problem is that the animal kingdom has a million different ways of doing things. So anything you want to prove, you can find an example from the animal kingdom to back it up, anything at all. The famous examples of the religious, la montre religieuse, I can't remember what it's called, the female eating the male, which is not typical in human society. You can always use animal arguments. Another example then, evolutionary psychology came from sociobiology, but it's not exactly the same thing. And this is the idea that it's an attempt to look at the world of culture in the same way as you can look at the world of animal evolution. So it's the idea that, you know, certain cultural practices are adapted by a group because it helps the group survive. Now, the positive side of this is that it's an attempt to make the analysis of culture more mathematical, more quantity based. And with all the massive computers we have around us, obviously, this could be an advantage. However, it's scientifically rather problematic because it tends to simplify how culture actually works. It's lost a lot of it's lost a lot of influence recently. Very last example then, memetics. Now, you've probably heard the word meme in Facebook, but this is a different idea of a meme. And this is a meme. Memetics attempts to analyze culture in a way analogous to Darwinian evolution based on the development of memes. So a meme is a cultural practice which can be copied. Analyzing this has interested a lot of people who are interested in marketing. How do you know that we say that some picture has gone viral or some video has gone viral? That means it's been copied many times on the internet. And of course, marketing people are very interested in understanding how you can make that happen. And this is one of the theories that they've used, which is the idea of dividing cultural practices up into units called memes, like genes. I don't find it very convincing. And in particular, semioticians have criticized memetics, considering that the idea of a meme is very simplistic, not simplistic, but simplistic, not as good as the term we traditionally used in semiotics, which is the sign. This is invented by the Swiss man De Saussure. A sign has always three aspects: the producer, the sign, and the reception. According to many people, memetics is oversimplifying the sign. Okay, well, it's only 5:02, but I've come to the end of my notes, so I think that's enough for today. Don't forget to look at the blog and be here same time next week. S'il y a des gens qui viennent en train, attention, parce qu'il y aurait moins de trains mardi prochain.